Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic and today I'm going to be talking to David Hughes. We're going to have an episode where we review a book rather than talk to an author of a book, although David Hughes has of course written a wonderful series of books about the greatest films never made, greatest science fiction films never made. And he's also written books about Stanley Kubrick and David Lynch. But today we're going to do a review of Meg Gardner and Michael Mann's Heat 2. If you are interested and you haven't had the opportunity already, you can also go back and listen to my interview with Meg Gardner a couple of episodes ago, two or three episodes ago. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
Narration. I still remember little bits of like David Essex as the artilleryman and him showing him how much he does.
Start a whole new world underground. Yeah.
Not poetry and rubbish, science.
And oh my God, seminal. I know. How did that become like, I don't know, there's it's just some stuff that's like pop culture that people sneer at now. And I know you're not like this, so I love to see that you among critics are very honest about your influences, be they, you know, from high or low culture kind of thing. But I do think there's this like massive snobbishness among critics sometimes where they won't necessarily acknowledge that the first time their, you know, blood was chilled or something was probably Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds and not James Whale's Frankenstein or, you know, Bela Lugosi as Dracula or something. It's like, come on, guys. We all know it was Salem's Lot, Michael Jackson's Thriller, you know?
Yeah.
And Threads, yeah. You know, Threads, that's fair.
Yeah, yeah.
Way, I think, you know.
I mean, my mum and dad were always really into the idea that we should, you know, it was like working class sort of autodidact kind of thing of like ragged trousered philanthropists. And when we got the video recorder, the first video they got out of the Shell garage that was sort of renting the videos was The Killing Fields. And it was like,
oh, wow.
You know, we're 13 years old. Can we watch something a little bit more exciting? It's like not just more exciting, a little bit more appropriate.
Age appropriate. Yeah, absolutely.
And like my dad was, no, it's really important you know about this. This is really important that you. And he wasn't like self-serious or anything like that. I mean, we'd go and he'd take me to Firefox as well, but
fair enough. Yeah,
they just occasionally get stuck on the idea that we should watch something important today.
Yeah, the Ragged Trousered Philanthropist. I think about that often. Actually, they just did a really nice graphic novel version of it. I don't know if you've seen that, which is well worth picking up. It's absolutely gorgeous. And a real labor of love for someone, which is worth checking out. But I just love the idea of a shell garage that has like Jaws 2, Porky's Revenge, and the Killing Fields.
Yeah, exactly. I remember it had Blind Fury with Rutger Howard. You remember?
I don't think I've ever seen that.
I watched it recently. I think it's quite a famous director as well. It's like Roger Donaldson or someone as a director.
Right.
But I remember the tagline, which was like, as fast as a cheetah, as fierce as a lion, as blind as a bat.
Sorry, I stepped on the punchline there, but yeah, oh my God, that's an all-timer.
Yeah.
And that sounds like it should have its tongue firmly in cheek, but period, you never know, you're never sure whether, you know, that's just a bad copywriter, you know.
It's fairly daft. I mean, it's not an out-and-out comedy, but it knows it's really daft. It's not, right. Wanted Dead or Alive was another one where they were just kind of selling him as this sort of like lead man and lead actor, and he didn't really ever fit in there. He was, those films are sort of enjoyable in themselves, but he never got out of the straight-to-video, bucket. When it came to, you know, leading a movie.
Yeah. He was pretty cool with that, though, I think. I mean, he was quite sort of comfortable with where he was in the sort of, you know, the movie star kind of pantheon. You know, it seemed very down to earth. I interviewed him a couple of times, once on the set of Split Second.
Right. Was that any good?
I don't know if Split Second was any good, but I mean, he was a really, you know, good value interview.
Right.
I don't put this in the recording, but I do remember that while I was interviewing Kim Cattrall on the same set, and she was in her trailer, and I was
wait.
And that's why neither of us are ever allowed back to Pinewood Studios again.
Banned, and rightly so. I'm surprised. I'm surprised you didn't get a longer sentence, frankly. Anyway, enough about your dirty experiences. By the way, that's another thing, actually. Rutger Hauer, his real lead performance was as a pint of Guinness in all those Guinness adverts.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'd totally forgotten about that. What was it about him that made them think, yep, it's an Irish brand, we definitely want Rutger Hauer to be our...
Because he looked like a pint of Guinness. He had the yellow hair and the black coat, and he was long and tall, pint-shaped.
Yeah,
not pint sized, but you know.
Yeah. That's pretty clever.
I mean, he said it isn't easy being a dolphin, and then didn't explain it. Everyone was like, "What the fuck does that mean?"
Man, what a presence! Yeah, that guy, incredible. Ridley Scott didn't direct those or something stupid, did he? That sounds like he could be right up his street. A massive brand like Guinness hiring.
Yeah. Yeah, you would sort of think that, I mean, I remember it being, even at the time, people going, this is a really innovative sort of advertising campaign, because it's not explaining itself. And you've got to kind of go, it's not easy to be a dolphin because dolphins can't drink Guinness. Is that what we're supposed to be drawing? Yeah. The conclusion we're supposed to be drawing?
Well, you know, you're still talking about it, like, however many years later that is, like 35... I guess years later, that's pretty cool. I mean, that is the power of deep, deep advertising, isn't it? I still sometimes sing the Shake and Vac music around the house, even though I haven't heard that commercial for probably 40 years.
It's like the Manchurian Candidate, isn't it? If I say quick, fit, fitter, you'll probably be out of the house running down the street to murder the Indonesian Prime Minister or someone.
Yeah, well, didn't To All Beef Patties, Lettuce, Sauce, whatever it was, cheese all in the sesame seed bun, didn't that become like a code word in that movie with Dabney Coleman, and who was the young kid who was in that movie Cloak and Dagger? It's like an 80s movie with a real edge. It's kind of like one of those Hitchcockian kid thrillers, but actually has like real
real
jeopardy to it. Yeah, and it was something about the code that the kid knew because he'd memorized that McDonald's ad or something like that. Maybe I've just made it up, but I'm sure it becomes like a key part of, again, like because the way that pop culture sort of seeps into to you so that you can't forget a certain sequence of words actually makes for the perfect password in a code situation, you know, because your password is do the shake and vac and put the freshness back. You will never forget how to say or spell that, or, you know, it's a pretty cool one, you know. Yeah. Except, of course, you'd have to have a number and a bloody symbol in it as well, so that ruins that.
But bastards. That's the, but I'm thinking of Equus as well, having the young guy. Colin Firth?
Peter Firth.
Peter Firth, yeah, jumping up and shouting, you know, juicy fruit gum or something, and sort of doing a. I was doing an interview with someone, and we got onto that talking about that. And who was it? It was a guy who did the Velvet Underground and documentary, and Carol. He did Carol as well. Todd Haynes, is it?
Oh yeah.
And we started talking about, he was having some gum, and I went, Wrigley's gum. I haven't seen that for a while, and yeah, remember, and started doing the song because I remembered it from Equus.
Yeah. Well, that's it again. You know, back to the sort of the high and low of pop culture, and you know, in a funny sort of way, I guess, you know, doing a genre movie. Like a Heat, because I know we have to start talking about Heat eventually, is a little bit like your kind of, I know obviously, you know, some great filmmakers, Kubrick included, have done like heist movies, but it's almost like that those directors know that they are not necessarily slumming it to be down with the genre films. And there's something great about a titan like Michael Mann or Scorsese doing a genre movie, isn't there? There's something very thrilling about that, particularly.
Yeah, I think the thing as well is that a lot of these people don't. I think it's much better if it's someone who comes from genre as well, because I mean, Scorsese started off doing Boxcar Bertha, and Michael Mann, you know, he's you know, made his bones in mainly in TV doing things like Crime Story and Miami Vice, and so their genre. That, you know, they're not sort of gliding in with you know, from the upper ether of art cinema to see what genre is like. You know, Kenneth Branagh directing Thor, they're already in the mud, and they're like, yeah, we can do this, but we now have the resources to do it like in a way which is much grander.
Yeah, and not looking down on it either. That's kind of. That's what I'm thinking about, the fact that they recognize that you know, cinema is kind of that genre obviously is a huge part of cinema, and not something that you can necessarily separate from the you know, from the sort of the quote unquote higher art, that it's all kind of in a blend. And obviously, you know, when I kind of came up watching you know, the Friday night horror movie with my mom or whatever, you know, and the Sunday afternoon film, I didn't know whether these were art movies, or, you know, don't know if The Old Dark House is, you know, made by a great director, because you're not really paying attention to that sort of stuff yet. So you don't really know the difference between a German expressionist masterpiece and an equivalent sort of American film from old Hollywood or something. It's just like, do you like it or don't you? And it's only later that you start to put those on sort of levels. And I think if you come in at that way, just as if you're a director who comes from genre, you don't necessarily see the difference between those. You know, it's the same art form, and what you're going for is, you know, is it any good?
Well, it's funny that early on in the conversation, you were saying, you know, you used James Whale as an example of sort of like, you know, something that someone who's a bit snooty might sort of claim to be their first, the first moment in the cinema. Whereas that, you know, that kind of old Frankenstein film, I grew up with those kinds of movies being on the television in the background of other movies as kind of look how sort of crappy American culture is, or this is some throwaway stuff, which as you get older, you think, no, it's more an affectionate tribute. But I was reading it in that way.
Far we've come, because now we're in an 80s horror movie.
Yeah, when now we're watching Fright Night.
Yeah, on Halloween, and they're watching this creaky old thing with Boris Karloff with his hands out and the bolts in his neck or whatever. And they are sort of, you know, the context of that makes you think, oh yeah, they're kind of taking the piss out of this creaky old stuff. But it's actually like, oh my God, this is the stuff that influenced me, you know. That's why I think I love Stephen King's Dance Macabre, because he just basically talks about all the stuff. And he doesn't know, as none of us really did, it was just what was on at the cinema that week. I was just as likely to go and see The Wraith in 1986 as I was Aliens, you know. And it's only really when you get there and you realize that one is sort of great and another one is something you buy on an Arrow Blu-ray, ironically,
Arrow
35 years later.
There are so many Blu-rays at the moment that are coming out that are so beautifully packaged. And you're like, oh yeah, let's get the box set. And it's just like, oh my God, this stuff's a bit shit. This would be in the bargain bucket at the supermarket. You'd walk right past it. You wouldn't give it a second glance.
Well, I've just put out Mazes and Monsters. Speaking of creaky old rubbish, that on a nice shiny Blu-ray now. This is my special limited slipcase edition of Mazes and Monsters on my little boutique label, Plumeria.
And so this is sort of like the Dungeons and Dragons kind of.
Yeah, exactly. This is but it's the Dungeons and Dragons Satanic Panic kind of thing. So it's Tom Hanks' first leading role, and basically 1982. And it's basically a kid gets a little too deep into his game of Dungeons and Dragons and kind of, loses the boundary between fantasy and reality blurs, but they can't use Dungeons and Dragons. So it's called Mazes and Monsters, it's great. I have to send you a copy, because it will be the nicest packaged rubbish that you've ever seen, probably. But I have a fondness for the movie, because when I was into Dungeons and Dragons and movies, there wasn't a lot going on. So, you know, I was like 14 when it came out or whatever, and it's like you would watch anything that had any kind of.
I got excited by He-Man. I as a kid, I was like, oh, He-Man, that's kind of Dungeons and Dragons-y. And
yeah, gosh, there wasn't a lot of it around, so you had to take what you could get. You know, thank God for like Conan, but I was probably still a bit young to watch that then, you know. Have been allowed to see it at the cinema, and video was just something that my rich friends had. So, you know,
it sounds like my mum watched Mazes and Monsters, because she definitely had a satanic pet. You know, I had to sort of hide my copies of White Dwarf and stuff.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she was really, because she was, you know, hardcore Catholic. And so she was like, this isn't about God. God never invented any dragons. And that's my Irish accent.
Right.
So let's talk about Heat too. So what's your relationship with Heat?
Well, yeah, David, that's a good.
What's your sort of
opening question? Well, I mean, I think my relationship with my relationship with Heat is. I remember you saying that you had watched it and thought, it's perfectly okay, and then you realized, like on perhaps a second watch, that you kind of were a bit blown away. I actually kind of thought, you know, it's a really, there are great, great things in it. And obviously a lot of actors that I really like. And but I never really had that love for it that people do. And every time I go back and sort of try to see why other people think it's such a giant, I feel like it's one of those films that has become sort of epic, probably because of the size of its performances and its running time and its general sort of look. It's got that massive screen feel, but and a, you know, a great, great cast. And I guess, you know, the Departed is another film that I feel a little bit like this, but I can never quite get there. So I did feel a little bit like I loved it enough to, and I loved Tom Noonan. I mean, anything that Tom Noonan is, I think he's just one of the, you know, the greatest things in screen. And so I would kind of, that's always been my sort of the highlight of that film for me. Every time I think about going back to watch it, I always think, oh yeah, I'm going to see it. Obviously I know what I'm going to see, but the bit that I really love is Tom Noonan, who is really one of the greats. And I've always been a little bit of a Michael Mann skeptic. And so when he makes a film that isn't so great, like Public Enemies or like, you know, Ali or whatever, you know, even the ones that other people love, I'm always a bit like, you know, the Miami Vice movie, I know it has its fans, but I just can't, you know, get into it. So it's never really been that strong a film for me, even though I know it's great. It's like great in a way that The Departed is great, not in the way that, you know, James Whale's Frankenstein is great. No, I don't mean that. but you know what I mean? So I'm not quite there with it. And yet, when I heard that Heat 2 was coming out, the first thing that annoyed me is that the 2 wasn't in the same font as Heat. And I thought, God, if you can't get that right, how are you going to, you know? And also, you know, there aren't that many characters left alive at the end of Heat that would make the sequel interesting. So I thought all that. And then I thought, leave it alone, you know, like you did when you interviewed Meg Gardner, you sort of admitted the same thing. And then I started reading it and... I had to get it anyway, because you've got to see what's going on. And then, and there's obviously a big fashion for belated sequels at the moment. And some of them have worked great. You know, there's been some fantastic ones. I mean, this isn't recent, but my God, Psycho 2, how is that so good? That's as perfect a belated sequel as you could ever hope to see. So I'm always hopeful about them because of Psycho 2, you know, it's like incredible. So I started reading it, didn't know Meg Gardner from A Hole in the Ground, you know, and I thought, oh my God, this voice, you know, the voice feels like I'm watching a movie already. And when they did a recap, open with a recap of what happened in Heat, and it was written so well, it was such a perfect précis of the sort of basically the important stuff and leaving out the stuff that wasn't so important, I thought, holy shit, this might actually be good. I better like pay a bit, you know, I better put my prejudices aside a bit. And then, man, I just thought it was great. I mean, I read it in a week primarily because you were, you know, the pressure was on.
Yeah, exactly.
While it was still current.
I was cracking.
But then
the whip.
I realized, you know, there's a reason why I've read it in a week, which is very, very fast for me, is actually because I can't stop going back to it, you know. So yeah, very interesting. And of course, when I realized that they got around the fact that Neil, you know, didn't survive the film by doing a flashback beforehand, you have that instant sort of prequel feel, as with, you know, Better Call Saul. Well, you know that these people survive, so because you know, it takes away a little of the jeopardy, but the writing is so sharp and precise and urgent. When you read a car chase on a page and it reads like you're watching it in a movie, it's like something else. And that can happen in scripts. Now, I haven't, to my knowledge, read a Michael Mann script of a script that Michael Mann has made, but I can imagine that, you know, the way that it feels to do that, it has that same kind of urgency and immediacy that the book has. So I think, you know, Meg Gardner with Michael's kind of guidance, however that relationship worked, has absolutely has created something that I guess it's what people get from reading Jack Reacher novels. You know, that sort of that urgency of action and stuff, and the added thrill of like Kelso turning up, of course, and you know, there being sort of flashbacks to. You didn't ask me what I thought of the book, actually, but you just asked me what I thought of the original Heat movie. But I've segued, so you know,
perfect. You do my job for me, man.
but you were a fan as well, weren't you? I know.
Yeah, I really liked it. I did have some criticisms, which, you know, when you're interviewing an author or a director, you kind of... Mm-hmm. I'm never going to give people criticisms unless they ask for them. It's just doesn't. It's not like So there were a couple of things that I, but they were relatively minor. And I think I had the same thing as you, that I just wanted to steam through it. And I was listening to it on Audible.
Same.
So So it was that thing of like sort of deciding to go for long walks, and it's okay, I'll go to the supermarket, I'll go shopping, you know,
because
I want to listen to another chat
than he's ever got in the past.
And the guy who did Pacino was amazing. Oh, I mean, it's the same guy, but when he did Pacino,
how do you like that?
He really did Pacino. Oh, great big ass. So I got that southern, slightly New Orleans, Louisiana feel to him. But
even
Pacino
when he was doing like subtle accents, like Anna has a very specific kind of international school. Oh, there's the international school thing. international school, you know, raised in sort of educated in London or
LSE and
absolutely. But it was obviously the Al Pacino impression that was so good. But he wasn't doing an impression of Al Pacino. He was like, you know, just kind of channeling Pacino in a really good way. So I thought it was...
It's the way they got... I mean, they got his voice. They obviously, with Michael Mann writing the script as well, he's going to know how to write for Pacino and going to know how to write that character.
Yeah.
But it felt like Meg had really... was owning those characters, and that when he walks in the room and he's putting people off with his sort of like a little bit of the Gene Hackman thing from The French Connection of, you know, have you ever picked your feet in Poughkeepsie?
Yeah.
It's that sort of like, what do you know? What do you know?
What do you hear? What do you say? Yeah, that's a Cagney thing, isn't it? Which I thought was very on brand as well for Vincent Hanna. There's a couple of lovely little, I probably didn't get them all, but it did feel like there was a couple of nice little Easter eggs in there, which sort of made me chuckle. But I mean, just that combination of, you know, Michael Mann's kind of, well, his whole thing, his whole sort of personality and you know, his background and everything, and meeting Meg's much sort of, you know, softer side. And let's face it, I mean, there are some great female characters in Heat, but it's such a masculine world and it's such a masculine movie that I wasn't prejudiced against, you know, this is what I was actually like celebrating in a way, the fact that there was a woman who was kind of steering some of the, some of these characters as well, because it just added it didn't add anything sort of softer necessarily to it, but it just gave a different dimension to the characters, I think, you know, particularly bringing out some of their vulnerabilities, which may have been there in the backstory of the characters that Michael knew, but weren't necessarily on the screen, because it's such a tough, they're such sort of tough sons of bitches, you know, and obviously it's the women who bring out the softness in those characters in that movie and also in the novel. And I mean, I was less taken with some of the Paraguayan stuff. I wasn't really into the developments of Chris's life as Jeff Bergman and, you know, that new relationship and that whole business thing. I was like, I sort of could have done without that whole thing and maybe some of the contrivances that get him where he needs to be for the final act without any spoilers. That was all a little bit too much. But the fact that I was as invested in the characters that were invented for this novel as I was in the ones that I knew from the movie, that kind of says a lot. And I'll be honest with you, this is the weirdest thing. I didn't think until I finished the novel and I listened to your interview with Meg, I didn't think of this ever being on screen. Mm. That's so mad, isn't it? Surely the first thing you should think of is, oh, I wonder if they'll ever make this into a film. But I wasn't. And then I thought, oh my God, yeah, actually, I suppose you could. You don't have Val Kilmer and you don't have, you know, this, that, and the other. But
I think this is a calling card. I think this is a relatively cheap way of working through a script in public. It pays for itself because you sell the book, so it's already paid its own sort of development money. And then you have, and then you also have an audience. You already have IP recognition. from the previous film, but you also have an audience that are like, want to see this particular story, not just, I want to see these characters come back. I want to see this actual story. And there are some very, very, I mean, it's not a criticism at all, but some very obvious kind of set pieces that you think, wow. I mean, especially towards the end and, you know, there's a scene which I can just picture how Michael Mann version of the film would look. And there's a scene in Mexico. There's a shit ton of scenes where you're just going, I would love to see this. And you know, there's a scene relatively early on, just so we don't get too spoilery, where Vincent Hanna is on the trail of the home invasion crew. And they kind of stake them out in a house and ambush them, essentially. And that scene is just so well written in terms of that I can see exactly what is going on, what the geography is, what the, you know, and it's as exciting as watching it in a film. You know, I'm really in there with the drama and stuff.
And when I think about it, I don't think about it as I picture it as though I have seen a film. And honestly, I don't do that with novels that I've read. There's something, and if people said, oh, that novel is like very cinematic or whatever, people say that about, like, I don't know, Stephen King's The Stand or whatever. And I'm like, I can't picture it, you know. But this one, without even the visual reference, I don't think I'm really referencing Pacino's Hannah that much, even with the voice in the audiobook, you know. More that it's just, as you say, it's so... it's sort of cinematically blocked, geographically precise. You know where everything is, like the scene with on the I don't know if it's the PCH. I can't remember where it is, but on the mountain road or whatever. No, it's not. But you know, it's on that sort of highway, and there's a scene that takes place where he just wants to go up and radio and can't quite, you know, manage that. But that, again, when I picture it now, I'm picturing the geography of how the mountain range and how the car and how everything is sort of placed on the... It's just amazing. So yeah. A credit to Meg and to Michael, I guess, for having that story sort of rolling around. It didn't feel like it was that, you know, there's a lot of killer, not much filler. And even the filler, I kind of get. I just wasn't that invested in that particular storyline, but which, you know, ironically is the storyline of the main sort of surviving character, you know, years after from the original crew, you know.
Yeah When I asked Meg about that in the previous podcast, I felt I'd put it a little bit, it was in danger of being a slightly backhandedly rude question of saying, did you ever wish one of the others had survived?
You know, like, you sort of did ask that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Halfway through asking it, it was like, it's like, I don't mean to say Chris is really boring, but you obviously Neil is a much more interesting character than Chris is, and even Mike with Tom Sizemore's performance in my head. I mean, I think he makes a lot of what probably on paper is a pretty nothing role, you know. But yeah, Chris doesn't strike me as the guy in the crew who you'd go, oh, I really want to find out what happens to him in a few years' time. But they sort of, I think she manages to pull it off. I mean, I did like the Paraguayan sort of the Chinese, the international, the interzone of this. Well, what Britain is going to be very soon, sort of like regulation free, feral capitalist. Do what you like. And, you know, as long as you don't kill anyone too important, we won't pay any attention, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to be living in a Michael Mann novel.
And I guess that the fact that stuff was set how many years was it 2000, I think that it was like 5 years after the events of Heat, wasn't it?
And 1999, 2000.
Selling
a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So still quite far, because I think they were talking about the handover of Hong Kong, which had happened like in quite recent memory then. So I think it was sort of around there, because that was 1999, obviously. But I think it was 99. But so it's still in the past. You know, we haven't jumped forward that much. And I guess, you know, I understand the reason why you were thinking that. But obviously, they very much are able to have their cake and eat it, because they can have a side story with Neil and the crew on another kind of. And yet it all plays into the story of this very big bad, who is, you know, one of the most evil characters that I've read about in a thriller for some time. You know,
just... he's pretty horrible. I mean, he is a little bit. I mean, this would be one of my, again, sort of mild criticisms. Is he feels a little bit like a replay of the character in Heat, in the, you know, the character in Heat who's kind of the person who Neil goes back to shoot in the end. You know, I'm talking to a dead man on the telephone, you know.
Yeah.
It has a similar sort of penchant for beating up and killing women and misogyny. And it's, I mean, that to me feels a little bit like a cheap trick. It's a little bit like the Silence of the Lambs. You know, here's a villain that you can hate and here's a villain you can love, you know. It sort of sidesteps your moral qualms about, you know, about liking Neil, even though he shoots people, unarmed men, in the very first scene of the movie, you know. But at least he doesn't beat up women. He's got a code, you know.
Right. I think we've come on a ways since those kind of conversations almost didn't take place, except perhaps among, you know, in sort of criticism almost, and sort of film analysis, like you didn't delve too deeply into those things. But I think television has really done a great job of making us look at, you know, from all sides, the nuances of kind of heroes and anti-heroes and villains or whatever. It's like, I guess, in the late, you know, from 1999, I think, when, again, you know, when The Sopranos started, it's like every time you started to love Tony just a little bit too much, he would do something incredibly despicable to remind you that he's the bad guy. You know, he's not the guy that you're supposed to be rooting for. And then when you sort of fall under the spell of someone like, let's say, you know, Kim Wexler in not even Saul Goodman himself or Jimmy McGill or whatever, when you fall under Kim Wexler's spell and think like, oh, you know, I hope everything's all right at home and everything with these two, because they're, you know, and then you just realize, oh my God, wait a second, what's happened to my moral compass? despicable people, you know, like watching Seinfeld and laughing at everyone and forgetting that these are literally the worst people.
I want to hang out with these terrible people.
But I think, you know, Michael Mann comes from a time when it was sort of all right to have a character like that is that evil, like Scorpio in Dirty Harry or whatever. Yeah. It doesn't have to be anything redeeming, but I think we've moved on a little bit, so it would have been nice to give him some sort of nuance. You're right.
I mean, to go back to what you were saying about Michael Mann right at the beginning, I think it's almost like he reminds me of one of those studios. There used to be a director. I was reading about him in the sort of noir book, and he basically had this small studio, and he had a pile of scripts. And what he would do, he would give a director or a writer the he had 10 scripts, and he'd give them it, and he'd say, okay, the last time we filmed it as a Western, go away and do it as a gangster movie, and then take the other script and write, okay, last time we did this as a gangster movie, go and do a science fiction version of it.
Right.
And he just had the same 10 scripts, but they just changed the setting and the names of the characters, and they'd do it again, you know? And I think Michael Mann is that kind of filmmaker where he doesn't really have a very broad range of interests. He can in the details. He can get really into the details. But in terms of like the excuse for getting interested in Ferrari or for getting interested in, I mean, his most sort of abnormal film, if you like, is The Insider, and possibly his best film as well. But it's got exactly the same concerns. It's still about masculine men and the men that they're masculine around the men who are being masculine and have to make hard decisions that the women around them, you know, can support or can buckle under or can, you know, but the men will, in the end, the men will be the men, you know? And I sort of see that as his... a very defined sort of thing that he does. And it's kind of like either you're on into it or you're not, or you're on board or you're not.
That's why I think of him in the same way that I think of like a John Huston or a John Milius or somebody like that, that he's just like that guy.
Yeah.
And you can't, but I forget sometimes that he's not from, you know, the same period as John Huston, but he's got those same kind of, that same kind of interest in masculinity about him.
It's in his goddamn name. Michael Mann. He is the absolute apotheosis of that, because it's the, you know, it's the one where you, I mean, the women, the female characters in Heat are basically, you know, women who are desperately trying to leave the men, basically trying to survive the men. They might love them, they might have, but they know the men are not interested in them. They know the men are not, they're never going to be the center of their lives or even be allowed to express themselves in any meaningful way. So, I mean...
But it still gets me every time at the end of Heat that he goes after the guy that he's got to go after, because I forget that the inevitability of that is nothing to do with what the audience wants. It's everything to do with Neil McCauley and who he is and what he can and cannot allow to happen. And he's been telling us who he is when he says never, you know, but so why am I under the spell and forget for a long time thinking that he's going to drive away and get away and all of that? And of course he can't. Of course, I'm the fool for thinking that he ever could step away from that and leave that gestalt kind of unresolved.
Yeah, but
and it's
but Michael so Mann would disagree with
turn
you
off the road.
Michael Mann would disagree with you, because he would say that's his downfall is that he leaves his code in that as a professional he shouldn't give a shit about this guy. He's done his job, he's got his money, out you go, and just leave it, don't care about it. And it's actually that's hatred that he's feeling has nothing to do with the job. It's nothing to do with the code. He should be on the plane. He's made his money, make his escape.
Oh, but it
pulls him back like an elastic band, you know, and he can't.
Yeah.
That's his failing. And I mean, on the other side of it, which I think is a very funny sort of flip to the is the sort of Natalie Portman scene where it's not very funny, but Al Pacino saved her from suicide and goes into the hospital, and suddenly you get this real world of there's other shit going on in these people's lives, and not being attentive, you know, being Jim Rockford is fine, but it's actually you're going to have a price to pay, and other people are going to get hurt. And the bit where his wife just says, you know, and there's a sort of reconciliation, and then his pager goes, and his wife just goes,
hi, off you go. You know, and it's just like the level of sort of emotional maturity in that scene is like, there's, and you know, there's no way he's going to go, no, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
I don't need to go after him. And it's like, you sure you're going to be okay? You know, as he's already getting his car keys out. Oh no, I'm going to stay with you. You know, it's,
yeah.
You got your car keys in your hand, Vincent.
That's quite rare, because often you'll see the scene where it makes no sense. It's like when two people who know something that's happening are talking about it together and they're naming like all of it, whereas actually you don't need to do the foundation because if the audience isn't there. So the writing that feels real is that kind of thing, not the, oh my God, could just once you put your family for, obviously that doesn't, you know, it now goes without that saying because they've been married that long that it's all unsaid, isn't it? It's just,
yeah,
you know, it's just there. She knows what he's like and he knows what he's like, and nothing's ever going to change that dynamic. So,
and I suppose in the book there is a sort of, you're in Heat 2, you're getting like, how did Neil become Neil? How did Neil become the Neil of the film? Did you find that satisfactory? Did you like that part of the book?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I liked the fact that it was sort of jumping around in time more than I thought I would. You know, at first I was like, oh right, I see what's going on here, and I did occasionally sort of get a little bit lost with where I was in the timeline, even though they kind of, you know, I shouldn't, because they make it very clear. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a big backstory guy. I don't need to know how these people arrived at this place when it's a fully rounded character. I'm not one of those people who thinks it's always reductive. Do you feel a little bit like that, that all you know, past is prologue and therefore can be excised? You don't really need that stuff. You're in the moment.
I wish there were stories. I mean, it's the common complaint these days of things like Star Wars. It's like, you know, the whole point of Luke Skywalker is he's a nobody in the middle of nowhere and he's bored. By the time you get to the umpteenth TV show, it's like, no, actually, Ben Kenobi isn't this old guy who's just sitting on his own for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. He's actually, all the time, he's hopping around doing other stuff and having adventures before. That, to me, really lessens the power of the original and it takes away from it. It's not so much that there isn't... The problem is, a story to be interesting has to be extraordinary. And if you're putting it in a universe in which stories are constantly happening, then that's no longer really narrative. It's soap opera. You know, I mean, the EastEnders never stops and there's a week in which nothing happens that's dramatic. You know, people don't fall in love or find out that someone's having an affair or somebody's stolen some money or someone's, you know, having a problem with drink or gambling or something. That has to be happening all the time for the soap opera to, and that's what makes soap opera so, you know, perfectly unsatisfactory, is that there's never going to be a resolution. There's always going to be something else. But that's a different thing we go to. So, I mean, any small problems I have with Heat 2 would be sort of things like, you know, did they have to be in the same city in Chicago at the same time? Mm-hmm. And that sort of, which, you know, Meg explains and says, oh, it's fun to have them almost meeting and sort of teasing that. And you could imagine in the film sort of having a car pull up just as the other car leaves and think, oh, they almost, you know. But to me, it doesn't cheapen it. That's a lesser version. That's something that doesn't worry me too much. But if it had been done a bit, if it had been done, it could have been terrible. Put it that way. Could have been a problem, and in the end, it wasn't. And as far as Neil is concerned, I actually think his backstory works, probably because of the process that Michael Mann went through, where he actually wrote these biographies for the first film.
Exactly.
And gave them to the actors. So there was nothing which was retrofitted. There was nothing that, oh, he was actually originally a political activist. Mm-hmm. And he worked, you know, with Martin Luther King when he was a young man. And then he got, you know, there was nothing that was, that didn't fit with what you already knew. And that was, I thought that was good, you know.
Yeah, he wasn't having to sit down and reinvent him from whole cloth, but now fill in all the blanks, you know. Yeah. Like, I don't really need to know where, you know, Doc Brown came from, and if Disney Plus launched a young Doc Brown series about how he got interested in something, you know, I wouldn't give a shit, even though he's like one of my favorite sort of characters from one of my favorite movies or whatever, you know what I mean? It's just,
yeah,
I find that stuff reductive, but not to the point where I want to gatekeep what they can and can't do like some people do,
but,
you know. No, you won't give me young Neil McCauley, because I don't want to know how he got to that place, you know.
Well, and in this book, you kind of don't get young Neil McCauley. He's already running, you know, he's having he's in the middle of a long career, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of refreshing for a heist, because the heist cliche is actually Heat 1, which is the one last job and then I'm out of here. One big score and then I'm done. And in Heat 2, he's actually doing one more score and then another score, and then I'm in the middle of my career, I'm just going to keep doing them for as long as I want.
Yeah.
And so that actually makes it sort of less of a cliche, and it's not, we're not meeting Neil in prison, and we're not meeting Neil as a young man under the wing of an older guy, and no, the thing you have to do, Neil,
he's fully formed as Neil McCauley, or that we know exactly.
You don't see him you don't see him as a child being dropped by his mother in a hot tub of water and her going, oh, I'm sorry, baby, it's the heat. It's the heat that hurt you, you know. And everybody turning to the camera.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And this is what's great. I mean, just to sort of, you know, maybe wrap it up, there is a great thing about this, which every time one of these works, it makes you more open and less cynical to the next one of these, you know, which is why, because some of our favorite films are remakes, you know, we have to be open to the idea. And because we've seen great belated sequels, and now, you know, we've had that a rare thing, which is a much belated novel sequel to a much loved film, and it works, I'll be more open to the next one. And obviously I'm going to be disappointed more often than I'm going to be pleasantly surprised. But this one was beyond a pleasant surprise. It was like, it's, you know, really captured everything that was great about Heat. Somehow, with the one thing I thought you couldn't put on the page, which is Michael Mann, you know, what he brings to the screen, that incredible cinematic, you know, visionary mind that he has to make even a story as sort of small as two guys riding around in a car feel somehow as giant as Last of the Mohicans. He said he wanted to do like a small movie that was a lot, you know, after Last of the Mohicans, what have you. Didn't want to do something as daunting as The Aviator, but so he chose Collateral instead. And he makes Collateral feel huge, because the backdrop that it takes place against is huge, I guess, but, and the characters are a bit larger than life, you know, just incredible. But I thought that would be a deal breaker, the absence of the visuals, and yet no, they're there.
Well, here's an interesting last question for you. We've had Quentin Tarantino, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the novel, the novelization, if you like, which was much bigger than the film in terms of its scope and everything. We've had Heat 2.
Which I loved tremendously as well.
Me too, absolutely. And we've had Heat 2. I'm not sure if we've had any more of these sort of, like, you know, we've had film directors write books before. Ilya Kazan did America, and, you know, it's been done. But could this be a who would you like to see next write a novel? Which film director would you say, oh, I'd love to see such and such, you know, put out their novel version of a film or a sequel to one of their films? Or
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah. I've just thought of one, actually, as I asked that.
Oh, go on. Tell me yours, and then I'll see if I can think of one.
I'd love to see David Lynch do write a novel version of his sort of Ronnie Rockets screenplay.
Oh, right. Okay.
That would be...
I don't love that script.
The script. Honest,
but I'd love to read a novel by David Lynch. Yeah, that would be something. I mean, we did have, like, you know, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, written by Jennifer Lynch, and we had Mark Frost do his kind of, you know, Twin Peaks backstory things.
Yeah.
But it would be interesting to see.
Jennifer Lynch, who's directing the Dharma as well. It's just in an episode that she did of Dharma on Netflix.
Right. Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah. She's kind of interesting director. What was the film that she made with, was it Bill Pullman?
Boxing Helena?
No. It was much later. Oh, I'd have to look that one up. You can cut that part out. I don't know. I mean, nothing comes to mind. I don't know if I'm would be crying out for a follow up to a film that, you know, that I love that hasn't been done. But the trick that I think that was missed, like, big time, was any kind of follow up to Sneakers, which is just such a perfect movie. The Phil Alden Robinson, it had an amazing ensemble. And those guys together, the incredible chemistry that those characters had. I mean, the you know, characters played by David Strathairn, River Phoenix, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd. I mean, Mary McDonnell, everyone as great as the next, you know, obviously Robert Redford. It's such a perfect ensemble that it breaks my heart that 30 years on, there still hasn't been any more Sneakers. And if there was a guy like the guy, I'm not a huge fan of the Fletch movies, but I know they have their fans. But if there was a guy who'd written like when you find out there's like, I don't know how many Forrest Gump books there are, but there's like a bunch of them, you know.
If there was Forrest Gump goes to Africa.
If I found out that Phil Alden Robinson was planning to sort of, you know, live out his twilight years writing Sneakers sequels, oh my god, you know, I would just eat those up. I wouldn't necessarily need to see them made as films, but just that would be the thing that I would do if I could. That would be the parallel universe that I would live in.
But then in the universe
they might have made a fourth Back to the Future film, and then obviously I'd have to destroy the universe that I lived in. So you know, I'll stick with the universe I've got. If I can't have follow-up Sneakers movies or, you know, a Sneakers TV series, just the best ensemble. You know,
I've never seen Sneakers.
Oh my gosh! Okay, that's two Blu-rays I've got to send you then. If you have a Region B player, you'll be fine. As long as you've got a European player.
So yeah.
That one we had to license properly, but yeah, I love it so much. It's not, I'm not plugging it for Plumeria, I promise you.
Oh, plug away. It's just when you mentioned the cast, it was so brilliant that you mentioned it kind of in reverse order of the poster. I could kind of see the people getting from small to big. And then Redford,
yeah, I studied Heat with Tom Noonan and worked my way up to Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
I was thinking, what's Tom Noonan in Heat? I remember the guy from The Simpsons. I remember Apu, the voice of Apu from The Simpsons. But
yeah.
Hank Azaria, and of course John Voight in Heat when he was still sort of like, well, before his sort of politics were more famous. I think his politics were already swinging well right at that point.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal in that as well, as Nate. Brilliant, David. That's absolutely, absolutely great. So
Surveillance was the word, or Surveillance was the Jennifer Lynch movie I'm thinking of with Bill Pullman and Linda Fiorentino, I want to say.
Yeah, that sounds right. Linda Fiorentino had sort of one of those strange careers where she was really huge with The Last Seduction.
Mm.
And then she did a few films, but never quite sort of like... I don't know. I mean, kind of, I imagine had a very long career afterwards as well, but didn't have a sort of that leading you know, she didn't break up into the Sharon Stone territory or the, you know, or the real sort of we can open a movie with this person's territory.
Yeah, I mean, she withdrew for reasons which weren't necessarily as clear then as they might be now looking back.
Okay.
And I email her regularly through her website, lindafiorentino.com, I think, trying to say, when you do an interview, you know, and look back on that career, because she did have an amazing, you know, she was one, I mean, she was one of the, not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but let's just say she was one of the actors who was potentially labeled as being difficult because she wouldn't necessarily play the game that, you know, that some would. And we thought of it at the time very differently than we might do looking at it through a Me Too lens, let's say.
Right.
And I think that's part of the story there. So, you know, I've no proof of that other than my own sort of gut feeling and the way that things sort of went down, and also facing my own prejudices about, you know, actors who were labeled difficult, you know, and looking at the reasons why those might have occurred. So I think there's probably an interesting chapter of an interesting book, which, you know, somebody will hopefully write at some point, which will be looking at the careers of people who kind of opted out of the system, and hopefully those people will sort of track, you know, that person, whoever it is, me, and God, I hope it's not going to be me. Hope someone else does the work. So I want to go and write another book about movies that never got made, you know, and hope Heat 2 isn't in it. And
I wanted someone to do that with my Twilight Zone book. That's I want someone to get lawyered up and do that. That's the that's got to be a great book if you can do it.
What's your Twilight Zone book?
Well, Twilight Zone the movie, the making of. I just, that story, there's been some good sort of documentaries and episodes of sort of movies from hell sort of thing.
But I
think it could either be a feature film documentary or one of those Netflix sort of four-parters or something like that, but it would just be such a legal quagmire. But I think it's there. It's so many people are responsible for that going wrong that never really who never really got blamed properly. And the people like the helicopter pilots sort of all ended up killing themselves because they were so guilt-ridden, and they got all the opprobrium sort of thrown on them.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think it's one of those things where the more, like you know, I have delved quite deeply into that, and the more that you delve into it, the murkier it gets, and the more people you love it touches, and, you know, it becomes very hard to separate the artist from the horror show that sort of became, and who enabled, co-signed it, and were sort of accessories after the fact in a way, in you know, covering all up and what have you. And it's all very much, you know, par for the course. It's what Hollywood's been doing since Hollywood was invented.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? But it's just that it's people from that generation of heroes that makes it hurt all the more. And yeah, pretty crazy. So, I hope I don't have to write that one, but you absolutely should.
Brilliant, David. Thanks so much for joining me again. But plug your DVD thing. Tell us about that quickly so people can find that.
Yeah, so Plumeria Pix, PICS.co.uk. Plumeria, spelled like the flower, Plumeria. Pix.co.uk. Basically, I started my podcast, which is an audio commentary podcast, because I was afraid that the audio commentary was going to die along with the DVD, you know, particularly the sort of studio commentaries. And one of the first episodes we did was an episode with the director and producer of a Peter Capaldi film I love called Soft Top Hard Shoulder. And after they'd recorded the commentary, I realized that there was no actual edition of Soft Top Hard Shoulder out anywhere in the world. So I kind of got the rights off the producer, put out a lockdown project, put out a nice sort of slipcase Blu-ray, learned how to do it. And then thought, you know, when that was all right, I thought, oh, I'm going to do few more of these. So I collaborated with Simon Brewer Film Stories on a special edition of Sneakers, where we actually pony up the money for the license, you know. Got a lovely interview with Phil Alden Robinson for the Blu-ray. And now we sort of got our next, we did Mazes and Monsters, just came out last Monday, 40th anniversary edition, with a lovely cover by Phil, the great cover artist. I've completely forgotten his name now. Sorry about that. But and then we're doing another title, which I think will be out before the end of the year, but I can't actually announce yet. But yeah, so I've got this little boutique Blu-ray business and looking for rights for films. And obviously there's massive competition in that area at the moment. So we're all fighting over the rights for the same films, and which is quite fun. So yeah, you've got to sort of snap up the good ideas because there's a lot of, you know, there's Arrow and Scream Factory, Shout Factory, Eureka, Indicator, Powerhouse, all these guys, they're all sort of fighting over the spoils of the movies we loved as, you know, when we were younger and stuff. And yeah, so
you've got to get,
we've got a couple of other.
You've got to get the big bus. Get the big bus. That's a great. I'm not sure if that's.
Oh, is that not? There isn't a Blu-ray of that yet.
I'm not sure if it's available, you know? I'm not sure if it's available.
I'll have to look into that. Oh. Yeah.
That's a sort.
Anyway, so plumeriapix.co.uk. And yeah, but we try and do them region free if we can. Mazes and Monsters is region free. It's not always possible because of the licensing arrangements.
Right.
We do sort of ship worldwide and it's free UK postage. And yeah, so I'll send you a couple of copies and hopefully you'll get to finally see Sneakers, and then you can get Phil Alden Robinson and persuade him to write Sneakers 2, a novel, holding up Heat 2 as the perfect.
Absolutely. You
know, the perfect persuasion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm right on that. I've got his email. I'll be sending him.
Good chatting with you, John.
Lovely talking to you, David. Take care,
thanks,
man.
Thanks for having me on. Best of luck. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
So that was my conversation with David. We had a really good time talking. As you can tell, just enjoy chatting with David any time. And frankly, this podcast is just an excuse to fulfill, to scratch that itch, so to speak. That War of the Worlds David Essex quoting itch that sometimes comes over me. So remember, if you enjoyed the episode, to like, subscribe, leave a review, spread the word as far and wide as possible. But all that remains to me to do is to thank Ellie Atkins for the music, Ellie Howard for the artwork, and thank you, listener, for tuning in. And we'll talk next week.